destination Russia. International routine still lingers for Wayne Rooney. Friday night, while England play away from home, have some booze and end up picking up points, it's much the same for their erstwhile skipper. We salute his old teammates anyway as they make the Maltese cross and round up the international weekend's other winners and losers. Ben Woodburn of Wales, Luxembourg, Spain, with the dawn of the 700 million euro player. There's League One and Two, who is Dave Tarpey, Scotland, plus Lamar, Barkley, anyone to Newcastle. We take a peek at the moves that didn't go through in the transfer window finale. It's all in a surprisingly interesting edition of the Totally Football Show. Yep, first day of school at the Totally Football Show. We've got two new boys joining us, ever so excitingly. First of all, Seamus O'Reilly, with your brand new pencil case there, Seamus.
Yeah, right here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts on what's been a pretty exciting international weekend. And also, we've got Luke Dowling. Luke, erstwhile sporting director of Watford. Not of Sporting, okay, that could have been ambiguous. But with a lot of interesting views, I'm sure, on the crazy transfer window that's just been concluded. Just to get you guys up to speed on the kind of the situation here, Ian is the cheery vicar type with a snake-like ambition. Yeah. And Rafa is the German who struggles a little bit in his second language but still makes one or two telling points. And I'm the big David Silva fan. And that's where we are. Raphael Honigstein here, everybody.
Good morning.
And Ian McIntosh.
Good morning.
Right, Luke, you've had an interesting career thus far. I'm just checking through the places where you've been. You've been at the white hot heart of the action. You were at Pompey when Michael Appleton was trying to keep a team together, and the fans were out with buckets trying to keep them afloat. You were at Leeds under Massimo Cellino, AFC Wimbledon as they remounted their challenge in the Football League. All sorts of Watford, three head coaches in 5 weeks.
Yes, my first 3 weeks as well.
You're kind of the pale rider of football, like hell follows in your wake. Now, it's internationals. Good weekend, as you've probably seen, for Mexico, Japan and Brazil, who joined Iran and Russia with places booked at next year's World Cup. Belgium also in the first European side through Roberto Martinez's side, hammering Gibraltar 9-0. You see Eden Hazard back in that game. And then they did De Greece 2-1 to seal their place. England continued their course, leading their group with a 4-0 win in Malta. Everyone really happy with this one. The fans booing and going home early. Ryan Bertrand as well with an extraordinarily long-faced goal celebration. Why is everyone so unhappy about this 4-0
win? Well, it was such a shame because for the first 5-10 minutes, it looked like England might be approaching it in exactly the right frame of mind. The passing was very quick, the movement was good, the fullbacks were pushed so high they were basically wingers, and you thought, okay, well, this will be short work. But I mean, Malta having the temerity to try and stop all of that happening, playing what was essentially a kind of back eight, and what happened to England, which has happened so many times, they just sort of slowly began to lose faith in themselves and their ability to actually do anything. There seemed to be this kind of gradual, all right, let's take it easy, we've got a lot of time, no need to panic, until, you know, it was getting quite close to the point where maybe we should think about panicking. It was all just so slow and turgid all over again. As I say, such a shame after the good start. Got there in the end. No one will ever remember it.
1st of September, what does Harry Kane do? Start scoring goals again. As for Malta, Rich Will says, good effort by them, but don't they realise you have to shoot to Joe Hart's left? And we should salute as well Andrew Hogg, Maltese goalkeeper, who had over 90 minutes without conceding against England between, you know, the two two matches, but still.
Very good early very save. Good. You know, you concede an early one in a game like that, and then lots more are going to follow. And that very early save was I'm clutching at straws for anything good to say about it. Wasn't fun.
And Ryan Bertrand looking miserable?
Yeah, just slam one in from long range. The keeper really should have had it. I suspect there was a bit of professional pride in not celebrating that because, you know, most goalkeepers would have blocked it. But look, it's 3 points, job done. France would have taken that yesterday against Luxembourg.
Fair point. Next up for England, it is Slovakia, and Gareth Southgate's boys can do Scotland a big favour here because Scotland are currently 4 points below Slovakia, who are in second place. 4 points below them after their 3-0 win in Lithuania. How did that result go down? And what else has been going on north of the border in this first month of the season, you're not asking, but if you were, here would be your answer from real-life Scotsman Jim Burke in our brand new feature, Beyond the Wall.
I'm impressed with the name Beyond the Wall. I suspect a bit of tokenism or lip service wouldn't have worked quite as well. But I get it. I live in Manchester. I'm no stranger to the comments in Scottish football. The thing is, you're not looking hard enough. The league's probably a formality, although at the moment Aberdeen are top thanks to a 4-3 away win at Partick. This fact, quickly overshadowed by the story of one of their players being fished out the river in Glasgow City Centre at 2 a.m. And that's the thing. A lot of people are missing the crazy that goes on in Scotland. For example, Celtic splashing out an incredible £5.3 million in the summer. Now, if we can't have the madness that huge amounts of cash in the game creates, then we've got to get more inventive to satisfy our appetite for batshit ball baggery. Let's look at the big two. Rangers have got Pedro Cucina, a fine man, articulate, cultured, enviable grasp of a number of languages, who, at his most recent press conference, delivered with a straight face the line, "The dogs bark, and the caravan keeps going." Nah, me neither. Now, over at Celtic, Brendan Rodgers, the one-time David Brent of English game, he's seen as both a visionary and a voice of reason in the game in Scotland. On the Partick Thistle mascot Kingsley, who bears an uncanny resemblance to Lisa Simpson and Crystal Meth, appeared on a TV panel show the other night. Gunnosaurus dreams of exposure like that. Now, on the field, Celtic have earned a place in the Champions League, where PSG and Bayern will pitch up, administer a sound thrashing, and then say nice things about the atmosphere. Now, in fairness, Celtic at home, they can give any team the game, especially if Dembele's fit and Encham lives up to his early promise. At international level, the man who would have invented wee man syndrome had it not already existed, Gordon Strachan, he's had a terrible result in Lithuania. A 3-0 victory has given the fans the worst of all possible feelings, hope. Now, this will of course be crushed in a hilarious manner, probably a defeat at home by Malta, which will undoubtedly usher in the David Moyes era. As Renton said in Trainspotting, it's shite being Scottish.
That Scotland win, here's James Norton saying, "Who needs Thomas Lemar when you have Andy Robertson?" Bizarrely, listen, I'm the only person who's seen the goal in question. Andy Robertson, who's of course wowing them at Liverpool these days, starts the move way down towards the corner flag on the left wing, bombs upfield, does a 1-2, and then unleashes a lovely curling shot into the top corner. At least that's how I remember it. Anyway, Scotland, do you know they haven't lost a match since last November now? They had the 1-1 with Canada, you know, then they had a 1-0 against Slovenia, and then the 2-2 draw with England. So possibly Gordon Strachan beginning to put together a little bit of traction there. Anyway, that Scotland. Next up, one of the moments of the weekend, right up there with the final whistle in Malta, and it came from Wales, that Ben Woodburn goal. Now, we all saw that, didn't we?
Yeah. Straight in off the bench, just wanted to larrup it from distance. I think by that point, heads were dropping all over the pitch, and you just needed someone to come on and do that. Very, very highly thought of. He's been with Liverpool since he was 6, I think. And he's been written about a number of times over the past 3 or 4 years as one to watch. And yeah, and Jurgen Klopp, he's got a manager who isn't exactly shy about throwing kids into the team. He's already played for the first team a few times.
Scored, I think, in the EFL Cup as well against Leeds. He's only 17.
Yeah.
The youngest ever goal scorer, isn't he?
Pretty impressive stuff. And it was a glorious moment because the crowd at the Millennium Stadium had just been, I'm not sure which anthem they were singing or which hymn they were singing, but there was some singing going on. It was all very moving. And the moment they stopped, boom, he unleashed that.
I don't want to diminish it.
Oh.
The goalkeeping for it was a bit... somehow the goalkeeper ended up flat on his back as it sort of passed above him. And I can't... I used to play in goal, not at a very high level, but I can't ever recall going underneath a ball, looking up at it as it goes above me.
It was just that kind of shot, I think. Yeah. The EPL pod boys, getting a sneaky plug in, say, is Ben Woodburn the next Ryan Giggs or the next Joe Allen?
Does he have to be either? Yeah. Either or? Yeah. I don't think we have to pigeonhole that early. He's obviously a talent. I think the playing for Liverpool, perhaps for all the progress he's made, showed that he's still got a long way to go. But international football clearly is not quite the same level as the Premier League, and it's a perfect opportunity to get some game time.
Mm. That was against Austria.
Yeah,
a decent team.
Decent, but you know, nothing
special. Besides, if we're looking at Welshmen who are quick, play off the shoulder, and aren't afraid to shoot, surely Ian Rush.
Well, there you go.
If we're going to make ludicrous comparisons, let's make them really ludicrous.
The victory takes the Welsh to just 2 points behind Ireland, who are currently in second place, 2 points themselves, behind Serbia. How worried are you and your nation, Seamus, feeling right now?
Yeah, not particularly relishing the qualifications at the moment. It seems a lot of the mood has kind of turned against Martin O'Neill, maybe just because it was fairly unthrilling, unspectacular football that really didn't do very much. I think against Georgia at the weekend, there was 360 passes by Georgia and I believe 105 by Ireland, 64 of which were accurate, so that means...
No, I mean, that's
in 90 minutes, they made 64 passes where they passed it from one of their players to another of their players. Yeah, and, you know, watching the game, it was just kind of surreal. There was 6 or 7 minute long periods where you just realise you're watching a football match because you were just thinking about anything else. It was there's a point where you saw all the midfielders just kind of crowding around doing sort of very random things, and it was a bit like whenever your pen runs out of ink, so you just start tracing sort of these inkless sort of scribbles just to see if you get the life back into it again. It didn't work on this occasion, but there seems to be, maybe because O'Neill and Keane have a sort of the old school razzle dazzle of being charismatic guys, they've been given a bit more time than maybe the results and certainly the performances would merit, but it seems like there's a bit of a shift now in how they're being talked about, even though, you know, if they win this game, they're top of the group and they are unbeaten, so...
Yeah, you're going to be hosting Serbia, which, yeah, if you win that, you'll be a point clear of them. Wales, meanwhile, are taking on bottom of the group, Moldova. So equally, they do have the chance, if it doesn't go well for you, against Serbia. When is this game, is it?
That's tomorrow, I think.
Tuesday evening. OK, so, yeah, it's a big day in that group. Anyway, well done to Northern Ireland, meanwhile, who, thanks to Germany's victory over the Czechs, are now all but sorted for second place. They are 8 points clear in second Northern Ireland, thus looking pretty good for a playoff position. They themselves had a 2-0 win, brace from McGuinness at San Marino.
3-0.
Was it 3-0?
Yeah.
Do beg your pardon. Still a brace, though, for McGuinness, I think. Yeah. And, there's one listener who keeps tweeting in, Luke, about the fact that Michael O'Neill, as opposed to Martin, goes very much under the radar. Are you a fan?
Massive fan. Massive fan of
Mike. What do you like about him?
I think if you look at, first of all, what he has to work with his squad, you know, I think there's probably less than a handful of Premier League players in the squad, and then he's going down as far as scouting players in League Two with what he has to work with. He'll change his system in comparison to who they're going to play against, so he's very, very open. I think everyone looked at the last qualification, and I certainly did as well, thought, is his time now to move on? Because he's taken Northern Ireland perhaps as far as, you know, they can go. He didn't, for whatever reason. He signed a new contract with Northern Ireland. And, you know, looking at the table now, as you just mentioned, they sit second behind Germany. If they get another positive result, you know, that's their playoffs secured. And he's done it again. You know, with what he has to work with, I'm so surprised no clubs in England have come and got him.
Right, and they're taking on the Czechs this Monday evening, so that could wrap things up for second. Why is it, you think? Is it just the lack of thinking outside the box that clubs in England haven't chosen to speak with him?
I just think it's perhaps people don't do their homework enough. Unfortunately for him, he's at Northern Ireland. When people mention Ireland, it's the Republic. Look at Chris Coleman. He's linked with jobs. Rightly so, he's done well with Wales. Martin O'Neill, if he resigns from Republic of Ireland for whatever reason, he'll be linked with jobs. I can't understand why Michael O'Neill isn't. Now, he may have been, and it's just not out there in the public domain. We don't know, but...
Did Watford ever look at him when you
yes.
were
there? Yes. Do you know, before I joined Watford, when I knew I was going in, and I was asked to, you know, go and speak to a couple of managers, and Michael was one of them, and was hugely, hugely, you know, impressed then. Hence why I've kept an eye on what he's been doing since.
Right.
Just at that time, you know, we're talking about nearly four seasons ago, he perhaps wasn't right, but now I think it is.
Hmm? Very nice. Rafa, that Germany win over Czech Republic, briefly?
Only just.
2-1.
Just 88th minute winner from Mats Hummels. But the game really overshadowed by what happened off the pitch. I don't know how much coverage you got in the English media, but there's some pretty horrific scenes with sections of the German supporters singing Sieg Heil and all sorts of horrible stuff, even as early as the German national anthem. And usually... what happens at this point is that the players say, oh, we heard nothing. But at this point, Mats Hummels said, yeah, we didn't go over to them to celebrate because we didn't feel like it. We were so disgusted with their behaviour. And it's brought attention back to a problem that I think has been sort of bubbling under the surface, but seems to be getting, unfortunately, more relevant now. I mean, these things happen quite often when it comes to games in Eastern Europe, because it's easier to, for people to travel, and it attracts the wrong sort of crowd, unfortunately.
Very worrying to hear. Okay, we'll be discussing more international news after this.
Tweet us at The Totally Show and find us on Facebook and at thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Last Thursday, we were looking forward excitedly to two pretty interesting-looking fixtures. One was France taking on Netherlands, and of course they won that 4-0, putting the Dutch in real problems and taking control of that group. But then they followed that up with that extraordinary 0-0 at home to Luxembourg. 0-0. At home to Luxembourg, they had 34 shots. They hit the bar twice. They did not score a goal. Just a couple of stats on this. Luxembourg's last clean sheet before this in 64 away World Cup qualifiers. In fact, their only other clean sheet, I believe, was in 2009 in Moldova. Luxembourg, that was from Johnny Blaine. This from Nick Harris. Luxembourg, since the 1930s in World Cup qualifiers, have only taken 24 points. Four of those 24 came in the last 4 days, against Belarus and now France. And how about this one? France's starting 11 for the game cost $400 million. A little bit over, actually. Luxembourg's starting 11, £27,720. Bless.
That's 4 points from six for Luxembourg.
It's crazy.
What an international week they've had.
Because they've beaten Belarus 1-0 just before this, yeah. Crazy, isn't it? Anyway, so, wow. France are still a point clear of Sweden in that group. But it's looking tight, isn't it? Bulgaria, 4 points behind the Swedish. The other really big match, anyway, that we were all licking our lips about, Rafa, was Spain's clash with Giampiero Ventura's Italy, which ended 3-0 to Spain.
Not much of a clash.
No, indeed not. As you yourself tweeted, not so ace Ventura. Nice. The Italian coach had opted for an intriguing 4-2-4 approach against the Spanish and came away with his first, or his nation's first, defeat in a qualifier since September the 6th, 2006, more than 10 years ago, I'm thinking. Let's speak to a man who was actually there at the Bernabeu, Filippo Maria Ricci. Ciao, Filippo!
Ciao, James!
How are you?
Depressed.
Ha! And you, on Saturday evening, were in the Bernabeu.
Unluckily so, yes.
OK, but at least you saw one of the most awesome national team performances we've seen in a while.
Yes, I was used to see Spain playing quite well. Then we beat them last year, only 14 months ago. And so I said, OK, that's the end for them. And perhaps it's the start for us. And but I was wrong. We both changed managers and we had a good draw, a decent draw just 10 months ago. And on Saturday, it was a nightmare.
Well, the curious thing about the earlier meeting in this group was that Ventura, the Italian manager, had tried out this 4-2-4 system, and things only improved when he reverted to playing three behind a striker. So why do you think that he decided it would be a good idea to try it again now?
It's interesting, the idea of playing 4-2-4. I always thought it could be a suicide. When I saw on Saturday, I couldn't believe my eyes. It was like Ventura never saw a game of Spain. Because if you go to play against Spain with just two midfielders, if at least three of the four attackers don't help, you're going to be slaughtered. Yeah. And that was it. Quite simple.
I know you were particularly taken with Isco's performance. He's been there in Madrid since 2013. Why only now are we finally seeing his kind of full range of incredible ability?
He can play, I think, only in one system. At Real Madrid, with a 4-3-3, he didn't know where to stay, because if you put him in the three midfielders, then he doesn't run backward. He only runs forward. So you can be, you know, in a disadvantage. If you play him in the three strikers, where do you put him? You have the BBC, Bale, Benzema and Ronaldo. What changed Isco's life was when Bale got injured, Zidane at last could put him behind the two strikers. And this is where Isco really can cause damage. So he has been freed. It took Spain and Real Madrid almost 4 years to accept his abilities. And
it's amazing, because I remember last season there was even talk of him going out on loan, possibly to Italy.
Yeah, and this year in January, and then in March he was flirting with Barcelona.
Now
his contract is apparently is not yet signed, a bit like Messi. Everyone is saying he signed, but he still have a contract that runs out in June 2018. I think he will stay at Real Madrid, obviously, but he didn't sign.
Okay. The new one that they got prepared, how big is the buyout clause?
700 million, they say.
700 million euros?
Euros, yes.
Wow.
What about that?
And what about Italy? They look miles off, but we've seen this against Spain before, say the final of Euro 2012 when Spain hammered them 4-0, and Italy came back really well from that. How far are they away the level they need to be, and do they have the people that they need to bring in, both on the field and off it?
No, I don't think so, to be honest. Obviously, Italy has kind of a thousand lives. No, it's always there. It's always fighting. It's always finding resources that that apparently are not there. First of all, the technical director, the manager is not up for it. He doesn't have the experience. He has the age, but he never kind of managed a great club. So I think he's missing something. And on the pitch, I think we are seeing the limits of Serie A. Serie A is getting better. But you have been there when Serie A was really, really good and strong. And it's not anymore. Let's see if things are changing, are going to change this year. Perhaps Napoli, Roma, I don't know, Milan spent well. But the gap is big.
Filippo, final question. How long before we see Gigi Donnarumma taking Gigi Buffon's place?
This is the other great debate that was opened by Isco on Saturday. This is a difficult one. His experience, his charisma, his words, I think, are still very, very important. So the debate is open. I'm not so sure that Buffon will be the goalkeeper of Italy at the World Cup.
Wow.
If we go to the World Cup.
Filippo Maria Ricci. Spanish sporting press next day after what was a huge win, which pretty much seals their top spot in the group. How much space did Catalan newspaper Sport give to this? Not a mention on the front page. Not a mention. They had a big interview with Ousmane Dembele saying, "I'm really impressed with Barcelona." Amazing, amazing. Here's Tom Jarrett saying, "Are Spain back to their best after that prolonged blip? Or is this the start of a new brilliant chapter? Also, is David Silva better now that he's bald? Are they back, Rafa, or were Italy just mental?"
No, I think Spain were hugely impressive. The pressing, the energy that they had. I think Spain, at the last couple of tournaments, just did not quite have the energy to play the Spanish way. They were not good enough winning the ball back. They looked a little bit sluggish, trying to make things happen without the crispness and the movement that you need to have a passing game. I think people always overlook that a passing is a kind of a collective thing, because it's about the positioning and having options, and it's not just one guy just being a brilliant passer, it's the others moving in the right space. And this was just wonderful to see the way they put pressure on the Italians. They couldn't quite get out of it. I think the fact that Italy, at least on paper, had all these attacking players actually made them reluctant to go the counter way, which would have gone route one, which might have been actually a way through the press. They tried to play out, which was admirable, but their passing wasn't good enough. And again, when I say passing, I mean they didn't have any real options in midfield, and the guys up front were sort of isolated. So Spain were just magnificent. And Isco and even Asensio were just, I mean, wow. They add so much dynamism and excitement to the Spanish team. It was hard, I think, watching them and not getting very excited.
Well, indeed. Although Italy really were the perfect opponents on that occasion.
I'm not so sure Italy were that bad. I think Spain
really the midfield
made them look very, very ordinary.
Verratti had a terrible game.
He had a terrible game.
And the lack of movement. I mean, as many people have pointed out, you can play four up front, but they have to kind of do a bit of work, which they really weren't doing. And the other extraordinary thing was, I mean, Ventura tried this before in the previous match, hadn't gone. He changed it. They ended up with the draw. This time, there was a total lack of reaction. 70 minutes before he did anything to the team, and then he took Belotti off, which I thought was
well. They had the spell after going 1-0 down, where they did create a few chances.
But it was the Belotti header.
Yeah, and you could see that Spain, for all the brilliance, still are like any other side, vulnerable to quick passes, you know, behind the defence and all these kind of things, but they just couldn't get enough of the ball, I think, to do it. It reminded me very much of the teams that played against Spain in 2008 and even 2010 to a certain extent. They were so tired of chasing the ball that when they had it, they just didn't deal with it very well. And I think Verratti was the perfect example. I mean, he looked so ordinary. His passing was so off. And that back pass to Buffon, I mean, you don't really see a player of his quality playing such a technically poor pass back to a keeper usually.
I think nutmeg twice by Isco in the course of the match. Italy then heading for potentially a playoff spot, which is worrying news for a lot of teams that are currently lying second place in their groups, assuming Italy do pick their game up a little bit. On the international front, just one other thing to mention, which we were talking about Uruguay's clash with Argentina. Argentina in fifth place and thus currently heading for the playoff with Oceania. Oceania's representative almost certain to be New Zealand, who in their first leg against Solomon Islands came up with a 6-1 win with a hat-trick from Chris Wood. Did you see his celebration for the first goal? He lowered his shorts.
What?
He lowered his shorts. He did have some underwear underneath, but he just basically... I'm not sure if he knew what he was doing. I think he was that excited, but he just basically lowered his shorts. Argentina, their clash with Uruguay, by the way, that ended 0-0, despite them having a front three of Icardi, Messi and Dybala. You were mentioning passing stats. How about this? Argentina had 708 passes in the match. Icardi made just four of them. Oof. And this was supposed to be his big chance.
Aguero as well on the bench for club and country now.
Rotten, isn't it? Anyway, so Argentina could be heading to a big clash with New Zealand. We shall see. Luke, quick question for you. Hazard featuring for Belgium after not featuring for Chelsea. If you're a sporting director of a club that has a player suddenly heal himself for international duty, how do you feel?
Disappointed. And the unfortunate thing is, once their national team calls them up, they have to report. So they have to report. They have to then be signed off as such by the national team doctor. So you can't even say, he's injured, he stays with us. He has to travel, go away, and for them to assess him to then send him back.
Oh, right,
ludicrous,
okay.
I know. But
quite a lot of time, though, don't clubs do that? Do they have to be on good terms with the national team to be able to pull that off? Or is there no way you can do it?
If both club and country agree, then obviously you can. But a lot of it can come down to the player. You know, if the player speaks to the national team manager and doctor and says, listen, there's no way I'm going to be fit. I prefer to stay around at the club, get fit. Then 9 times out of 10, they'll allow that. But players are players, and some of them, you know, have a lot of pride meeting up with their country and certainly playing. Obviously, Hazard's one of them.
Yeah, some of them don't, of course. Anyway, right, we'll be talking more about international football a little bit on Thursday, no doubt. We'll also be looking forward to the return of club action. Tell you what, though, after this little bit of music and other things, we're going to be tackling some of the big mysteries, the most intriguing questions that remained after that rather curious Thursday transfer deadline day window finale. Listeners to footballing podcasts will know that there's enough tough decisions to make these days without having to worry about which razor to use. So why don't you take the hassle out of your shaving routine by signing up with our pals Cornerstone? Never run out of blades, never need to shop again. Just let them know how often you shave and they'll take care of the rest. Get £10 off your first order and find out more about your perfect shave box at cornerstone.co.uk/totally. Seamus, did you enjoy the transfer market closing?
I did. I enjoyed it slamming shut. Was it Jeff Stelling or was it...
Well, it's Richard Keys Richard who Keys. Said that it doesn't slam shut, it just closes.
Yeah, he just worked out what a metaphor is in real time.
Really?
In front of people, so...
Where did you see that? Was that on beIN Sports or something?
It was on Twitter. He just said it. Said it was very condescending. It doesn't slam shut, it just closes.
Right. It doesn't smash or anything
when it's a notional concept anyway, so it doesn't actually do anything.
Well, when it did come to whatever it is it did, the Premier League clubs have spent £1.4 billion, which is up 23% on last year. Rafa, I'm guessing most of that is because of the fall in value of the pound. Is that right?
No, I don't think so. I think it's in line with revenue.
Is that
going
right?
up by almost the same percentage. There was a very interesting article in The Times that basically said transfer spending follows income relatively strongly, so a strong correlation.
Yeah.
So they're basically just in line and with profit going up or income coming up.
My kind of article.
Yeah, exactly, James. And also half of that money was actually spent within the Premier League.
Ooh.
So the pound's fluctuating value wouldn't have
That's so
made
true.
A difference there.
No money spent on Alexis Sanchez going to Manchester City or for Philippe Coutinho going to Barcelona or Virgil van Dijk going from Southampton to Liverpool, because none of those moves happened. And neither did Thomas Lemar go to Arsenal from Monaco. And it's the deals that didn't happen, I put it to you, that were the most interesting thing. Let's start off with Arsenal, because even by their standards, they really were perplexing. Last Thursday, Chippy's Curler says, is there any precedent for the head-spinning combo of incompetence with just enough lack of explanation as what is going on at Arsenal? Luke.
Well, Joe, I think with what's going on there with the players, and Oxlade-Chamberlain going, Ozil and Sanchez in their last year, does it all go back to the uncertainty with Wenger in the summer?
I don't know.
So you look at players... Players will want to know what's happening with the manager, whether that's players that remain at the club and looking to sign a new contract, or whether that's players that you're trying to bring into the club. Now, the fact that it was left that late before Wenger made a decision, I think may have hurt them a little bit in the transfer window, bringing players in early on.
But Sanchez, for example, now that we know that Wenger has signed a new deal, Sanchez, who was clapped by his Chile teammates in really poignant scenes when he announced them that morning that he was going to Manchester City... And unlikely, I'm guessing, to be clapped by his Arsenal teammates when he returns from duty. What did they never intend to get rid of him? Was it all down to this Lemar business? Did they actually want to sign Lemar? They offered. They're now saying 100 million to Monaco. What happened there?
Well, ultimately, if you try to do your business correctly, you'll try and get the players in before you know that the ones are going to go out. And I think that may be the situation with Lemar. They looked to get him in as a replacement for Sanchez, and then the Sanchez deal was falling down for whatever reason. No one will know unless we're part of Man City or Arsenal. But I think that's the situation that's happened there. You know, once Lemar doesn't come in, can they afford to let Sanchez go as well, knowing that Chamberlain's already gone out the door?
But can you afford to keep him and thus miss out on, what, 60 million that Man City were offering? And then he sits around being grumpy, and it doesn't sound like he's desperately popular with the rest of the team anyway. So as a sporting director, what would you do at that point?
I think Arsenal need Sanchez more than they need 60 million.
OK.
Even if it's one season.
Right.
They need to get back into into Champions League football. So that is the most important thing. If I'm Arsenal, if I'm the sporting director there, let's get back into Champions League football. Going back on, you know, on Sanchez and the reaction of the players, from what I've heard, Coutinho, Van Dijk, Sanchez, they're liked by their teammates. Let's be honest, if I'm an Arsenal player, I'd rather have Sanchez in my team than not.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, so the fact he's going to come back and join the group, I'll be delighted.
Because this bizarre thing of Arsenal offering whatever it was, 90 or 100 million for Lemar about 5 minutes before he took the field with France that evening. You got all summer to do your work.
You have got all summer, and you can start a deal, believe it or not, at the beginning of the summer, and it go that, you know, that take that long until you get to the end of the window. That looks like it was a last minute thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, forget the international game on Thursday. Even there was no game at all. For a player to leave a club that he's happy at, that he hasn't come out and said, I want to leave, to go to a different country, okay, he knows Arsenal, he'll know about the Premier League, that needs more than a day. You can't just, you know, it's not saying we want to take a player from Southampton and he'll make his mind up immediately, yes, I'll go to Arsenal. We're talking about a player leave France to come to England, family, you know, what his family have to say about it and things like that. So to try and do that on the last day surprised me.
I think that smacks of a PR move.
You think so? Yeah. They didn't actually want to.
Well, I refuse to believe that someone as experienced as Wenger thinks that that can all happen like that in sort of 2 minutes before the transfer window shuts. I think they've made it public just to go, we are trying.
Mm. That's a really impressive snap of the fingers.
Thanks, mate. I've been practicing.
Really nice. Rafa, it looked like you were going to pitch in something there.
I think it shows the disadvantages of doing a very market-driven strategy.
What do you mean by market-driven?
Well, I mean, Arsenal... under Wenger of the last few years have been very reactive. They tend to do deals when players become available. That's when they get active. I mean, Mesut Ozil is a great example. You know, he was forced out of Real Madrid. Suddenly, Arsenal showed an interest, and again, it was a deal done on deadline day. They hadn't made any effort, to my knowledge, to make that deal happen before, even though, you know, there was strong suggestion that he might be the one. It was between him and Luka Modric at the time that Carlo Ancelotti might let go. And you know, this is so frustrating, and I really get up every morning thanking God I'm not an Arsenal fan, because as a neutral, it drives me nuts. I mean, to be so careless with the way you handle your squad. First of all, to let these players go into the last year of the contract is already, I think, a dereliction of duty for a well-run club. To have so many of them in this position, three in Arsenal's case, is insanity. And then to spend the whole summer saying these guys are not going, but then actually secretly changing your stance. But then after agreeing the deal with Sanchez, then saying, sorry, we can't let him go because we can't get replacement in. I mean, no wonder City and the player are really pissed off by all accounts, because that is just such a weird way of doing business. You know, if you change your mind, that's fine. After saying he's not for sale, you actually do want to sell him because you feel his attitude is bad, or maybe you feel, you know, 60 million is too good a price to turn down. That's great. But then why? Then do it. And surely you have to factor in the chance that that's going to happen. And you can't then, as Ian said, on the last minute or last, you know, hour of the transfer window, then try to spend the money.
And the worry is now that he is in the last year of his contract, that come January 1st, he can start to negotiate a move away on a free or to another European club. A lot of talk of Real Madrid being interested.
Yeah, as they call it, the cross-border deal on January the 1st. Just going back to Sanchez before I go, you know, go back to a cross-border move. The World Cup in the summer, I think, is vital for the club, for Southampton, Arsenal and Liverpool, with the three players that didn't get their move. Because I don't think they can down tools now. They will
all
get
of them
back
will
in
have
the
motivation.
Side. They've got motivation to go and play to get into that World Cup squad and ultimately that World Cup 11. Because their attitudes, as far as I'm aware, have been good, I think for Southampton and for Arsenal, it'll be like a new signing. If you'd have asked the majority of Southampton fans and Arsenal fans leading up to the Thursday deadline, do you expect to see Sanchez in an Arsenal shirt again? They'd have probably said no. The same with Van Dijk. The fact that they will be, is it like a new signing for the season?
Yeah, but the weird thing is, though, that they spent all this time over the last few months bad-mouthing Sanchez, releasing these figures.
Briefing against him.
Yeah, that, you know, his stats are not very good. Even Wenger made the point in a press conference saying, look at his stats. His stats aren't great. I mean, it's an incredible thing to say for a manager. And, you know, we read about his attitude being wrong and his teammates not liking him, being isolated. And again, it's not really a joint-up strategy, because they're doing one thing and now they're saying, we made a principled stance of not selling him. Where actually, no, it's not true, because you did actually agree to sell him only to change your mind when you couldn't get a replacement. And so it really doesn't paint a pretty picture.
No, although winning a few games will probably heal all sorts of problems there. Arsenal have had plenty of other summers when they didn't make too many moves, but one after a season in which they dropped out of the top four, you'd have thought they'd have gone out and maybe reinforced. To give you a little stat on that, even Newcastle signed more players than them. Chelsea, they got Zappa Costa. A lot of people saying they didn't get rid of Costa. Very nice. That's producer Ben there. Tick. Also, Danny Drinkwater came in. But what happened with Ross Barkley? Ian, do you know what happened with Ross Barkley?
Well, Ross Barkley says that he didn't have the medical.
He didn't have the medical?
Yeah, and that he feels that as he's not fit yet, he can take more time to consider his next move.
OK, because there were stories that he was upset that Everton hadn't let him talk to Spurs, and so he was essentially rebelling against what they had ordained for him.
Yeah, and the rumour is that he really wanted to go to Spurs.
Why did Chelsea want Ross Barkley? Is that a valid question? Does he improve their squad?
Ross Barkley, when he's at his best, is an exceptional footballer.
Right, he'd do well at Vitesse, you think?
The problem is that there are too many occasions where he goes kind of rogue. Roy Hodgson was driven to distraction by it. Ronald Koeman's never entirely trusted it. He is a very, very gifted footballer. He does have a few limitations, and he probably hasn't kicked on as everyone thought he would maybe 2 or 3 years ago. I'm not actually convinced that Tottenham wanted him. I mean, they might have, you know, mentioned that he was quite good at, you know, being polite, drinks reception or something like that. But I'm not sure if they were actually really wanted to go in and get him.
Are you suggesting they were just trying to annoy Chelsea?
Well, I just think it's, you know, when you say, oh yeah, we must grab a drink sometime, that kind of thing. Maybe they just said that and it's got out of control. Because there didn't seem to be
like concerted efforts on Tottenham's behalf to get him.
In England, if you say let's go for a drink sometime, that means please don't call me.
It's just maybe just not your everyone. Experience, Rafa. Luke, how often do clubs make a transfer bid just to disrupt another club's activities?
That does happen.
Name names.
that does happen because you're trying to drive the price up for someone else and you're thinking, right, they're going to get him and we're not. Let's try and make it as expensive as possible for them. So that will happen. Just going back to Ross, I know his agent well, and there's no way Ross would have gone to Chelsea, had personal terms, had a medical and walked out.
Right.
So the fact of him wanting to go to Tottenham, he could have spoke to Tottenham quite easily. All Tottenham have to do is match the price that Everton were asking for and he can go and talk.
So what do you think happened then?
I just think that he may want to go somewhere else and he's not fit till December time. So with that in mind, let's wait till January. If nothing happens in January, Ross Barkley will have a massive selection of clubs in this country alone. And I mean the top ones, the Chelsea's, the Tottenham's, Man City's, potentially Man United because of the homegrown quota for the Champions League. We saw Raheem Sterling go for the money he went to because probably, OK, talented boy, but, you know, homegrown for their Champions League. So Ross may be looking at it thinking, I'm not going to play till January anyway. Let's just go back to Everton, get myself fit and look at it again in January.
Well, that makes perfect sense. But wasn't it really curious, the fact that it got that far down the line with both Everton and Chelsea apparently oblivious to his position?
Well, I think I'm surprised. We didn't at Watford, and I haven't done it previous clubs. If you're going to bid for a player, before you bid and waste time, you need to speak to the representatives to make sure that they want to come to you.
Yeah.
And if they do want to come to you...
That's illegal, Luke.
It is illegal. That is illegal. But, you know, to make sure, A, would the player be interested, and B, if he is, are his salary expectations going to fit in with the club?
Right.
Because if those two don't match up, let's not waste time and go and make a bid, get it out in the public domain that Watford want this player when it's not going to happen.
Just lastly on this Chelsea business, what do you think of the fact that they used to be the club that poached other people's moves? Now they can't seem to sign any of their first choices. What do you think's going on there? Is it Michael Emanuela's lack of contacts? Is there some other issue there?
No, Michael's contacts. Michael will know everyone because everyone will want to know Michael. You know, right. He's the sporting director of the champions in England.
So why can't they lock down any moves?
Is it the manager uncertainty? Does he know that he's going to be there the whole season?
But they've always changed managers, you know, quite a lot. But it's funny how there's been that change. They used to get the players they wanted.
Costa. You know, do people look at the squad and say, OK, have they got the squad now? OK, they won a league last year. Have they got the squad now to go and retain it? Perhaps not. Are players looking at it? I don't know. It does surprise me, but it also surprised me that you let go Matic and replace him with Drinkwater.
Or you let go Nate Chalabar.
My bias head on now. For value for money, sign out the window.
Why did you say that?
Nathaniel Chalobah played 3 games for us, and he's in the England squad. Okay, Gareth Southgate knows him. We all know that from the under-21s. Is Nathaniel Chalobah good enough to play in Chelsea's first team for 15 to 20 games over the course of a season? I would suggest yes. So the fact that we can go and get a player at his age that can do that for £5
million... £5 million? That's all you paid?
That's all we paid. £5 million. I'm not saying he's the best player in the window that's gone. For value for money, he's the best, in my opinion.
How much did Aki go
players,
to Bournemouth for?
20.
Wow. So how did you get him for 5?
What we do at Watford, with myself, with the chairman, Scott Duxbury, who's a shrewd operator, you know, when it comes to it, if he wants something, he'll just keep going till we get it. It's about acting there and then. You know, it's easy to pick up the phone and say, oh, we have an interest. You know, I've said this before. Instead of picking up the phone, it's Chelsea. They're 10 miles away. Let's just go and knock on their door and get a deal done. We're not leaving until we get a deal done. The boy will come to us.
Right, same way Odin Wingy did, of course.
Yeah. You know, the boy wants to come to us. He wants to play. He knows he's not going to play every week at Chelsea. He will play games, but not enough for him at his age. He's now too old to play for the under-21s for England. So if he stays at Chelsea, where's his football? You know, last year his football was England under-21s. He's now gone past that stage. So he wanted to come. Let's just get a deal. And for that money, for that player at his age, is a great business.
Are Newcastle going for constructive dismissal with Rafa Benitez? They promised him all the money. They moved out. He held up his end of the bargain. He got rid of a bunch of players. And then they said that he could have any proceeds from that. And then they went and got absolutely nobody. And we all know how this is almost certainly going to end with.
Yeah, but Rafa's not political, so he won't take any issue with that.
All right. And there's the spectre of West Ham now, because it also looks like... I mean, am I wrong? The statement that Sullivan released about Slaven Bilic telling him, no, I'm happy with my squad. You want to offer me Renato Sanchez and, let me get this right, Kuskos Krychowiak, who West Brom signed, and thanks Rick Carla for that pronunciation. But yeah, so the two of the outstanding signings, Renato Sanchez, who went to Swansea, and Krychowiak, who went to West Brom, that West Ham could have had them, but Slaven Bilic said, no, David Sullivan, we don't want him. Is that the club releasing a statement like that? Is that them actively briefing against Bilic in preparation to shipping him out?
Yeah, I mean, that feels like the pointy edge pushing him down towards the end of the plank. something isn't quite right there, because he's... That just doesn't feel like it's going to last at all. And in reference to Benitez, as far as I understand it, there's a $6 million buyout clause on his contract, which any club would have to pay if they took him. Mm. And we know this because someone is making it very, very public, along with the information that he would absolutely take any kind of job right now. I don't know who could be making that information public in the press.
Who stands to benefit
from
that knowledge?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a murky world.
But I've also been told that if he walks... there's a similar figure that he has to pay back.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Could you just say that again, Luke, but with my information is at the start? It just sounds better that way. Yeah. I'm kidding, of course. Seamus, you wanted to say something about David Sullivan.
The brinksmanship around the Carvalho deal. He said that it didn't go through because he couldn't attend the medical and they didn't have time.
So this is Willem Carvalho.
Uh-huh. From Sporting.
Sporting.
And this was not just rebuffed and denied by... Sporting, I think it's director Nuno Saraiva. It was he took to Facebook and unleashed a pretty incredible rant where
what did he say?
I'm quoting, "The football industry is not the set of an adult film where all obscenities are allowed. So the boss of a club demands a lot more than this intellectual pornography," and went on to call him a parasitical liar.
Right. It's such a shame to hear the West Ham owner linked with pornography.
Exactly. I think he did his homework there, yeah. It was pretty strong stuff. I'd love to see more of that, actually. I think more people should be, you know, in charge of football clubs and just use it as their little bully pulpit.
I don't think we should, though, because David Sullivan is, I think, exploring legal options right now.
Right.
Shouldn't recommend that all sporting directors do that.
Yeah. Okay. Right, so West Ham, yeah, probably Bilic, no longer very popular. Newcastle, we'll see what happens with Benitez. Danny West flagging up the growing trend, as he puts it, of English players going abroad to do football. Ravel Morrison, for example, who's joined Atlas FC in Mexico. The curious thing, Rafa, is that so many of them have gone to the Bundesliga. You've got Ryan Kent, who's gone to Freiburg, Kalen Hines to Wolfsburg, Reese Oxford... Remember his stunning debut for West Ham against Arsenal? He's joining Borussia Mönchengladbach. Yeah. Chris Willett, meanwhile, going to Portugal to join Benfica. But the most interesting one, I think a lot of people have said, is a player that you know, I imagine, Luke, Jadon Sancho, was at Watford and has just gone from Manchester City to Borussia Dortmund. He's got Ousmane Dembele's old jersey.
Yeah, and £10 million Dortmund paid for him.
Right, he's 17 years old.
I think there's two things here happening. First of all, and you can go back further to non-English players who were signed from Premier League youth teams, like Anders Christensen, for example, on loan, who has done wonderfully well. I think there is a recognition among scouts, or at least the better ones, that these Premier League teams have an amazing array of talent in the second teams who just, for whatever reason, are not quite good enough to break into the first team, don't effectively play any competitive football, and are... increasingly open to move because they want to play internationally. They want to play in a proper league. They you know, don't want to play in front of 5 or 10 people in Harlesden on a Tuesday night. And this becomes, I think, a very interesting and logical move for both parties.
The thing on English players going to Germany, I think Christensen has just come back to Chelsea. People may not realise he was on a 2-year loan out there. So he was there for 2 seasons at Mönchengladbach playing. Now, I think too many teams in this country take players on loan for the sake of taking them, just to fill their squad. I think if you look at the German teams now are doing their homework a lot more, and they're taking these players, and 9 times out of 10, they'll go and play. Mm. And I think that's the important thing for the players at English clubs. They're looking at it, they're going. Stadiums are full every week. The football's quite similar in terms of to the Premier League. So they're not going to play out in Spain where it's pass, 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 a lot of it, and then come back, and then suddenly you've got a centre forward right up your arse. You know, it is very, very similar out there. So I think Christensen is a prime example of it that's come back at Chelsea. He should now, he's at a crossroads in my opinion, he needs to play at Chelsea or he needs to go. You can't have two full seasons, which in Gladbach playing, come back Chelsea, and you're on the bench. So that's my view on it. On Jadon Sancho, the first thing I had to do when I got to Watford was sell him to Man City. This boy is a hell of a talent.
Right.
And I'm led to believe he was training regularly with Guardiola at Man City. And before one session, or before his last session, I should say, he asked for 5 minutes of him at the end of training, which he got, and he said, I'm going. He said, you keep signing all these players, I'm never going to break in, I'm off. And didn't come back.
Fair enough. His career is looking pretty special. His performance at the under-17s with
this is a boy I think we need to, you know, hold our hands up to and say, well done, because the size of the contract that he was offered at Man City was phenomenal for a boy of his age. Now, he may be getting the same at Dortmund, but he's a boy from Battersea. He's going out of his comfort zone to Dortmund because he believes he'll go and play there. And if he does, he'll be back over here in this country. I'll be surprised if Man City haven't got a buyback clause.
Interesting. Is he going to play, do you think, Raf?
I think he'll have a hard time breaking into the first 11 straight away because Dortmund have so much talent in those positions. I mean, somebody like Christian Pulisic, who's not even 19 yet, he's been keeping out the likes of Schürrle and Götze and Emre Moore, who had to move because he didn't get any game time. It's a huge chance. I mean, Dortmund will happily look past your age and put you straight in and even play you in a Champions League game against Real Madrid, as they did with Pulisic as an 18-year-old. Even as a 17-year-old, he played in the Champions League, but you have to show that you are adaptable and you can do it. Emre Moore, who was a talent of similar, who he still is, of attracting similar excitement all around Europe, his attitude was not conducive to starting, and he's been shipped out because they felt he will never really be ready for this team.
All right.
That's really the key. I mean, there's absolutely no doubting this boy's talent. He's absolutely exceptional. Really inventive, game-changing player, comfortable on both feet, to put it mildly. But English players just have a very, very poor record. Ollie Burke didn't quite cut it. That Scouse lad that Bayern Munich signed, whose name completely escapes me.
Yeah, I remember.
Listeners, anyone?
They signed him from Tranmere.
Yeah, he didn't make it, so, you know,
remembers him now?
He'll be listening to this, go, oh, come on, I was all over the papers.
I think the thing with Burke,
in fairness, there is not many players go from Tranmere to Bayern Munich.
No, it hasn't happened often.
The thing with Burke was that...
By the way, Dale Jennings, if you are listening, I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, Dale.
I mean, it's quite remarkable because Leipzig officials, both Hasenhüttl, the coach, and Ralf Rangnick, the sporting director, actually repeatedly went on the record explaining that Oliver Burke, basically, in so many words, doesn't quite have the tactical knowledge.
A blank hard drive.
Yeah, was the word to thrive in that system. And I think Sancho, having been brought up under Guardiola, at least for part of his career.
And his time at Watford.
Yeah, and his time at Watford.
Yep.
should have an easier ride.
Brilliant. All right, well, you know what? There's loads more we could say about the transfer window. I'm not sure we will in the fullness of time. Great to have your insight on all of that, Luke, as well as, of course, all of the rest of you as well. A little bit of music, and then it's time for Football League. Football League, Ian McIntosh. Benny says, what will become of Brentford's season after Ari signed three of our first teamers on deadline day?
Well, it hasn't been a great start to the season yet. But,
has it not?
But there's, you know, they buy very shrewdly.
All right, resting anyway last weekend because of the internationals and that. League One, League Two were in action. Ever so briefly, bring us up to speed on the bullet points.
Hey, League Two, Exeter, still unbeaten, 1-0 win over high-flying Newport. Grecians are only... one of only two teams in this division still unbeaten, Stevenage being the other.
Right.
There was another bad day for Swindon, who were top of the table just over a week ago. They got walloped by Harry Kewell's Crawley last week, and they got pounded 4-1 by Barnet.
Right. Harry Kewell's Crawley...
They won again.
That's two wins in a row, because they've beaten Yeovil 2-0. Luke, he was youth team manager at Watford when you were there, no? Harry Kewell.
No, he was the under-21 manager.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My mistake. Sorry.
Yeah, we gave Harry. I gave Harry his start in his coaching career. It was our first year.
What made you pick him? Because I must admit, he's not one that I ever thought of being a manager there.
No, the reason behind it was we 2 seasons ago was our first year of having an under 21 squad. So it was new to us all at Watford, and when we were looking for a coach, the same names were getting put into us all the time.
Who?
Just ones that have been at Brentford, Southend.
All right.
Just done the rounds. I'm a young sporting director. We had a young coach at the time, Kike Sanchez, the head coach.
How nice was he, by the way?
Brilliant.
Was he really? Was he as nice as he seemed?
Yeah, he was. I'd love. He was
because we were all gutted when he left.
Yeah.
So are you still in touch at all?
So was I.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all was right. I. So he was just met Harry. So enthusiastic to get into the coaching. And let's be honest, I've said it to people and he won't mind me saying, for what we was paying and what he's earned in his career, the fact that he was leaving his family up in Cheshire and he was staying down here on his own to coach our under-21s showed that he has the appetite to do it. I thought he'd be a good one for our young boys to look up to. He's relatively young, they'll know who Harry Kewell is. And, you know, it was tough for him, it was tough for us because it was new to us having an under-21s. But as time went on, you could see he was getting frustrated because he wants to be a first-team manager. And I think he would have admitted that himself after the first season. Now he's got his job at Crawley. They didn't have a great start, but I'm delighted now. The last two games, they've picked up some points, and I'm sure they will continue to do that.
Crawley creeping up the league, says Ben. He's not got much to do there. Hey. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, anyway, back to... Right, so that's League 2. I've got something I wanted to ask you about League 2, but do your League 1 stuff. We'll come back to it.
OK. In League 1, I'll tell you who hasn't got back-to-back wins, and that's Peterborough. After four in a row, they finally got stopped by Doncaster. Just behind Peterborough, who are still top, keep an eye out for Shrewsbury. They spent most of last season fighting relegation.
Are you pronouncing that correctly?
Shrewsbury. I'm pronouncing it as Kelly told me to.
Okay, all right.
She knows these things. They were fighting relegation most of last season, but they won 2-1 away at Gillingham, second in the table. Manager Paul Hurst, who I know you remember, got Grimsby back into the Football League a couple of years back. They play really nice passing football, very reminiscent actually of Southend in about 2006, who won the third division title playing that sort of football.
Nice universal example there. Charlton have continued their fine start with a 4-3 win at Oldham. The winner coming from Joe Doodoo, is that right?
Yes.
There's nothing funny, that's his name. but anyway, so that's nice. Has there been any change in ownership terms for Charlton?
No, it's still the same regime. But the difference, I think, is Carl Robinson, who is a very affable young manager who did very well at MK Dons. And might just be the conduit to kind of hold it all together. It's a very easy person to like.
Okay.
I say that, he'll get sacked in 2 weeks. And finally, in the Championship, happy birthday Sheffield Wednesday. It's their 150th birthday today.
150?
Blimey. Yeah.
Speaking of Football League, anyone who's feeling like that was a bit of a mad scramble through two very interesting divisions, you've got good news for them, haven't you?
Yeah, keep listening all the way to the end of this podcast and there'll be some news for Football League fans.
Okay. Do you know Dave Tarpey, Luke?
Yep.
All right, because Barnet have signed him, so he's finally made it into the Football League. Tarpey, who I was down doing a Maidenhead game recently, and that's where he's moved to Barnet from. Incredible record. Last season, 44 goals in 40 matches. In the league, 35. This was in the National League South. A bit in one match in particular against Dartford when Maidenhead won 5-0. He scored four of the goals, and one of them is just ridiculous. It's a very optimistic punt upfield, Rafa, from the goalkeeper. He flicks it over his head with a back heel, takes a touch past the defender, and then, cool as he likes, slots it away. He is that good. And the only thing is he's a bit slow and short, and he's 28, and that's why I guess no one had... Because we asked the Maidenhead manager, actually, you know, how many clubs have you had coming in from? He said, no one's called at all. But now finally somebody has.
He scored goals in fairness before he was at Maidenhead. He was at Hampton
right.
Richmond. So he scored goals. I think, unfortunately for him, his age would probably just go against him. Hence why there's a League Two club just taking the chance on him. If he was 24, we may be looking at some League One clubs taking him.
He got four against Fylde away in his previous match before this. Fylde away. but without him, Maidenhead still beat the National League leaders, Sutton. All right. Now, before we leave, you should salute everyone involved last Saturday in the game for Grenfell, which saw a win because the result's so important for Team Ferdinand, 5-3 on penalties over Team Shearer. Moo was in goal. He converted his own penalty, Mourinho. Scoring was opened by Mo Farah. All sorts of other exciting things.
The other thing I was really impressed was that Olly Murs managed to go and do that one, and then another one, I think, 2 days later, meaning that I think he just does them every week.
The latter-day Jonathan Wilkes.
Yeah. Very nice. All right, you can still donate, by the way, to the good causes that that game was championing. If you want to text Grenfell to 70007, that will be a donation of £3. That's Grenfell to 70007. Well, we seem to have come to the end of today's Totally Football Show. Anything else you want to add, Seamus?
Only that I will still be coming back and forth with more Steve Bruce.
Steve Bruce. Is there more? Is there an undiscovered work or something?
Well, that is obviously the dream, but we're currently going through a process of trying to make the definitive sort of literary resource archive of Steve Bruce.
Fantastic. Did anyone... It's a little bit like Shakespeare. Did anyone ever work out whether it was actually Steve Bruce who wrote all of Steve Bruce's works?
Well, I've commonly said that I'm the only person who's read all three, including Steve Bruce. But
okay.
I'd say there was probably a little bit of ghostwriting involved, possibly whatever the more extreme version of ghostwriting is, like a poltergeist.
Poltergeist, right, yeah.
Where it's, you know,
just random stuff chucked to the word processor here. Alex Bruce, of course, yeah. His son, had let slip that...
That was very funny. Yeah, I got an awful lot of interaction off that because basically he let the cat out of the bag, supposedly some people thought, by saying, oh, no, he didn't do that. And then about 14 hours later, he issued a reel, oh, I was only joking.
Right.
Of course.
Whoever put those books together, though, I mean, they're
masterful works.
They're a rare talent.
They are. Rare. And now very rare books as well, because I think he suppressed them, like sort of Soviet Samizdat kind of. They get passed around by sarcastic journals.
Lou, it's probably time we let you go. Many thanks for being with us today. Fascinating stuff. Rafa.
Thank you.
Nice one. Ian McIntosh.
Phil.
Seamus O'Reilly. Looking forward to seeing you again soon. And producer Ben. Listeners, thanks very much for your patience. We will be back on Thursday with Club Football on the horizon. I know you'll be joining us then. Have yourselves a great week in the meantime.
Wow. What do you think of the pod then? It's all right, wasn't it? Good puns in the intro. Bit of chat, bit of info. Yeah, lovely. There wasn't much football league though, was there? I do keep trying to crowbar it in, but for some reason, everyone prefers to talk about Arsenal and whether they'll finish fifth. Well, I've had just about enough of it. I'm starting my own show, the Totally Football League Show. It'll be a bit like this one, but it'll be more about the stories, because that's what the Football League is. It's stories. Uplifting ones like Burton Albion and Forest Green and Lincoln City. Less uplifting ones like, well, Sunderland. We'll be sending our man Matt Stanger up and down the country to get in amongst it with the fans and the managers and the players. And if he survives, he'll be joining me in the studio each week with a special guest to report back on his adventures. It's the Totally Football League Show, Totally Football League, totally free and available absolutely everywhere from Tuesday, September 19th.
The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com and tweet us @thetotallyshow.